from Oregon to Georgia, New York to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is embroiled in controversy over its frequent revisions of jobs numbers. Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here for a look at how the BLS generates those statistics. President Donald Trump wants to redo the 2020 census, this time to include only American citizens. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is joined by Jillian Snyder of the R Street Institute to discuss the nation's declining crime rate. And on this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says new ownership gives the CBS network an opportunity to restore its news division's lost integrity. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Bureau of Labor Statistics issues monthly jobs reports, but those reports are prone to large and significant revisions as the weeks go by. Here for a look at what the BLS does and how it does it is Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Sean, our discussion today is going to center on the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I would venture to say most folks either haven't heard of it or maybe don't really know what it does if they have. So tell us a bit about the Bureau of Labor Statistics. What is it and what is its mission?
The Bureau of Labor Statistics is a sub-agency of the Labor Department, and its job is literally to create statistics about work. They crunch numbers on all manner of subjects, but the thing that they're best known for is the monthly unemployment numbers. Every month they survey businesses and they estimate where the unemployment rate is. And so when you see a news segment that says unemployment rate is 4.2% or something like that, that's coming from what the BLS says.
So this department has been churning out these statistics for many decades now, but it's now in the news because President Trump a week or so ago fired the director, didn't like the numbers that they presented. There's a number of different ways of looking at that, but let's start out with looking at the fact, Sean, that there are frequently, almost every month, revisions to the number of jobs that have been created in particular. Why is it that we seem to constantly be having revisions month after month after month?
Because it's hard to get an accurate snapshot of the economy within a month. We're just that large of a country. We're 330 or so million people. And we have an enormous number of businesses. The economy is constantly growing and changing. And just creating sort of an accurate, here's what's going on this particular month thing is a gargantuan task. It's hard for anyone to do. The way it works is, they send out this voluntary monthly survey to about 121,000 businesses and government agencies, just ask them where they are and how many people they've hired. And they only get responses of about 60% or so of those people or those entities. And then as more reports come in, they revise the numbers further. So that's why, when they say one month, we're up 120,000. I'm just throwing a number out there for the sake of argument. Then the second month will say, oops, we're wrong. It was actually 150,000. And it's because they got more responses in the intermediate time that made them adjust their numbers. So, and this is this thing that's been happening with the Bureau ever since it has existed.
Is it necessarily wise then for so many economists, for the Fed, for policymakers at the federal level, for businesses making decisions? Is it really the emphasis that gets put on these numbers? Should that really even be happening?
People should view these numbers with more skepticism because they are basically just estimates and guesses based on a sample of the population. And it's a constant moving target. I mean, I think they earnestly try to do the best they can, but they're still, and they're smart people, but there's the ones at the BLS, but they're still human beings and they're still fallible and they can still make mistakes. And the other thing is, the question is, what exactly is the methodology? Is the way they're sending out surveys and waiting for them to filter back in necessarily the best way to do it? Possibly some of the other things, such as to look at payroll surveys and this type of things are probably a better way to look at some of the trends in employment.
I think you raise a good point there. Should they have more inputs into the final data number that they come out with?
I think so. For one thing, the economy has changed a lot, particularly in the last two or so decades. The system that the BLS uses is based on essentially the 20th century model, which was people went to one employer and stayed there for a long time, and it was mostly traditional employment. But we've seen the economy change and shift a lot, and technology has aided the creation of a whole new categories of jobs that just simply don't, I don't know how or even if the BLS accounts for. I mean, things like the gig economy and jobs like ride sharing. How does that, if someone does that for, say 8 hours a week just to get some extra money for groceries, how does that ping on the BLS survey? What about other things? I mean, people like YouTube influencers and other social media type people. What about people who drive food trucks? I mean, all the sort of other things that have come up that are legitimate ways for people to make money and earn a living, it's not clear how or if they're accounted for in this. And I think there's, as a consequence, there's a lot of gaps and blind spots in it. Now, having said that, I'm not exactly sure how you would do it differently. I'm just simply saying that it's a gargantuan task, and they're probably doing the best they can, but that doesn't mean that they're getting it absolutely, completely right every month.
When it comes to public opinion research, polling, whether it be for political campaigns or whatever, pollsters are always changing their methodology, Sean. They're making certain assumptions. They're doing weighting in order to try to get an accurate snapshot of where public opinion is. Is the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, trying to use some of those types of processes as they develop these numbers, or have they been pretty much static for decades in the manner in which they approach it?
They have been experimenting with some of the things, and one of the issues is that they're actually getting a lower response rate from the surveys they put out. And part of the other issue may be there that I'm not sure that they actually have a very good methodology for determining when businesses go out of business, and so therefore they're not getting responses back and tracking the creation of new businesses so they can get surveys out to them. They use statistical sampling and that type of stuff to bolster the numbers and try and get things. And the problem with that is, in an economy as large as the one we have, even the tiniest mistake in a statistical sample can be sort of replicated exponentially as you bring out the data. So it can be off by a substantial amount innocently.
We saw back in the month of June, Sean, they came out with a number of new jobs that was significantly higher than anybody anticipated. Then in July, it was significantly lower than anybody anticipated. Is this just part of this normal problem? I know the president and some others are questioning the reason behind this, but is this something that we've just seen replicated over and over again related to all the problems that you have just outlined?
I think it's something that has happened historically with the BLS. I do think the adjustments and the swings are larger now than they have been in the past for some of the reasons I've talked about, because the economy is changing and shifting, and they are getting a lower response rate. So I think that's probably accounting for the larger shifts. So on the one hand, it's an issue that's been around for a long time. It is getting a little worse, in my opinion. Some numbers crunchers and statisticians claim, the data isn't necessarily any worse, that if you look at the longer trend, that there have been substantial shifts as well. But it seems, I have been following this as a reporter and a researcher for a while, and I don't think I've seen quite as many shifts in as short a period of time as I have seen in the last few years. So I do think they're having a harder time getting a handle on just the raw data.
We have been talking about the Bureau of Labor Statistics and problems with the methodology and how they come up with job numbers, unemployment numbers from month to month. We've talked about it here with Sean Higgins, who is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, tell us a little bit about CEI, also a website you've written on this quite extensively. Where can folks find that?
The Competitive Enterprise Institute can be found at CEI.org, and everything, all the sort of stuff and a whole bunch of other things from my colleagues. I have quite a few smart people there, can all be found on that site.
Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. As always, Sean, thank you for taking time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. A lot of talk this past week over congressional redistricting, over the U.S. Census. We're going to delve into those issues today. Scott, as always, good to have you here.
It is a pleasure to be with you, Loman. Thank you.
President Trump this past week, Scott, floated the idea, maybe more than an idea, that he wants to redo the 2020 census. Why would he want to do that, and what is the goal?
In 2020, President Trump called on the Commerce Department as they worked through the census to exclude undocumented individuals, illegal aliens, illegal immigrants from the census. And ultimately, there was a court decision, I think it was New York v. Trump, where they basically indicated that there wasn't precedent to do it. They didn't issue like a final ruling saying it couldn't be done, but the illegal aliens were counted in the 2020 census. And so here we are in the situation where we know how narrow the House majority is. You know that there are probably somewhere between 15 and 30 million illegal aliens in America. Big, big number. And when it comes to reapportionment, how many congressional districts each state has, California, New York, Illinois, Texas, there's a lot of illegal aliens in each of those states. And this isn't just, I think, a pure blue state issue where they're residing. But when it comes to the sanctity of an individual's vote, we know from the 2024 elections that illegal aliens were voting before. And so what Trump has called on Secretary Lutnick and the Commerce Department to do is to exclude illegal aliens from a census and not wait until 2030 to conduct that work. He's called on them to do it immediately. And of course, I do think this will be challenged in the courts by leftist circuit court judges and other individuals that basically want to skew the proportional representation of American citizens. So it'll be something I think is going to probably be drawn out. But to Trump's point, the Commerce Department should get to work right away. And it's a lot of effort to conduct the census, and it's a constitutional requirement. There's also the Census Act that establishes the norms for that. And I think that it would be a good thing for the future of our republic to make sure that only American citizens are counted.
That, of course, as you pointed out, likely to be a long, drawn-out court battle here. Might take us actually to 2030. In the meantime, the Lone Star State, Texas, not waiting to 2030 to take a look at their congressional districts. There is a proposal to redraw the district lines in Texas. That has triggered quite an interesting set of circumstances here. I want to bring us up to date.
The big thing that the listeners are mostly aware of is that the Democrats have left the state of Texas, and they're trying to prevent this work from being conducted and the new maps from being enacted. Ken Paxton is the attorney general in Texas, and he's seeking court orders to basically determine that these members have vacated their own representation of their districts. And at the same time, the governor is calling on them to return if they don't. I think some of them are in Massachusetts conducting press conferences. Some of them are in other states. But the Democrats there, they talk about gerrymandering. But look at states like Illinois, for example, right? There's huge gerrymandered districts that stretch for hundreds of miles to basically protect Democrat incumbents. And what President Trump and the White House and the Texas legislature and the Texas leadership in the governor's office are trying to accomplish is basically to have fair districts drawn that would result in more Republican seats. Sometimes when seats have been drawn before, there's precedent where they would try to protect black districts. And we've seen that happen in states like Florida up in the panhandle. You've also seen it recently with a Supreme Court case in Louisiana. And basically, the Supreme Court has ruled that no, you don't need to make these based off of race. And so I think that when you redraw these maps, it's going to be some Republican bright red districts in Texas going from probably like an R plus 20 down to maybe an R plus 8, which is, you know, a little bit more competitive than some of these incumbents would like when they're facing a tough election in 2026. But ultimately, that'll balance out the congressional districts and probably create an opportunity for us to pick up 4 or 5 seats in Texas We also have redistricting opportunities in states like Ohio, and that process should be completed by, I think, October there, where I think we're going to pick up 2 seats. And there's several other states. Florida's trying to get 1 more seat. And the issue with the Democrats is they have independent commissions, not the legislature, that redraw the congressional maps. And so it's not like Gavin Newsom can just snap his fingers and call the legislature back to a special session to get this done.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. If you want to learn about the candidates that we're supporting and the races that we're following, check us out at clubforgrowth.org, where you can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thanks again for being here. New statistics show violent crime in the United States is decreasing. To parse through the numbers, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is joined by Jillian Snyder of the R Street Institute.
You know, bad news gets all the attention, it seems like, and that's particularly true when we talk about crime. If it bleeds, it leads, is what the, you know, famous newspaper aphorism is. You don't often hear good news when it comes to crime, and this is some really good news that I think we should be talking about that we're going to take a look at this week based on the new numbers in the FBI crime stats report that was just released. We're going to dig into that today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jillian Snyder. She's a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute and a retired New York City police officer, and she's here to talk us through some of the what I think is really fantastic news in this new FBI crime report. Jillian, thanks for being here on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the big picture here, which is that it looks like violent crime in just about every category has dropped. What is the FBI's latest data tell us?
So yes, every category of crime did have a decrease. Overall, violent crime decreased about 4.5% compared to 2023 numbers. But some of the most staggering numbers are really that murder dropping almost 15%. That's huge from last year. Additionally, we saw a significant drop in motor vehicle thefts. If you recall a few years ago, one of the big news stories was how many carjackings we were seeing, particularly around juveniles. They were saying young teenagers were going out there and stealing cars left and right. So seeing that considerable drop, I think it was about 18%, if I recall, that's really big numbers. So overall, this would make most people assume that they are safe relatively in their communities.
Yeah, and of course, you know, this is all local data, really is probably more important than national data to most people anyway. Different places have different numbers and all of that, but obviously great news across the board. Does this mean, I mean, there was that weird spike, and not all that weird really when you think about it for 2 seconds, but I mean, there was that spike in crime of all kinds, you know, after the pandemic and after 2020. Have we finally emerged from that weird period in American history?
I would say, you know, 99% surety, yes. We have to also look at other contributing factors. Obviously, COVID played a huge role in that crime spike. So when you have the majority of the country in lockdown, where they're not free to do what they want, or people are, you know, not working because they're furloughed or laid off or whatever the case is, that, you know, contributes to economic instability. Additionally, 2020, you saw other things post George Floyd, a lot of civil unrest, to be completely candid, just with people coming out there not feeling comfortable or confident in their law enforcement. That also behaviorally will contribute to crime. If people don't trust the enforcers of the law, they're less likely to abide by the law. So I think that it's safe to say that we are seeing, you know, positive trends. We are seeing crime trickling back down to that pre-pandemic level. Obviously, we need to take this with a grain of salt, though, because this is only crimes that are reported, and that's something that most social science researchers will always say. Yes, this is something we can use to analyze trends over courses of time, but because this only accounts for when people actually report to the police, we are not seeing that dark figure of crime. We are not seeing the crime that does not get reported to local law enforcement.
I think that's a great point, and certainly it's more complicated than just the, you know, looking at the trend lines alone, even though the trend lines all great. And it's really just awesome to see that we've been able to kind of put some of that chaos back in the bottle, because I was sincerely worried after 2020 that maybe this was just going to be a thing we were going to have to deal with going forward. Obviously, some places still are dealing with that, but to see these national trends, this is really tremendous. We are chatting with Jillian Snyder. She's a senior resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute and a retired New York City police officer. Jillian, a little bit of time left here. I want to ask you about, you know, the political spin on this. Seems like it's pretty obvious to me. Democrats are going to say, well, look, crime was falling last year anyway. We just didn't know it at the time. So we don't need Donald Trump's law and order policies. And Republicans are probably going to try to take credit for this decline in crime, even though it happened, you know, and this is mostly the result of local issues anyway. It's not the result of national politics, anything like that. Okay. What's the take for somebody whose brain hasn't been poisoned by partisanship? How should a normal American, if there's any of us left out there, look at this and take away from this?
Well, something that I notice, I also teach, I'm a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, and I talk to my students regularly about crime reports and crime statistics. And, you know, obviously living in New York City, we're fortunate that we get our crime stats every week because NYPD puts it out every Sunday. But even though they understand the numbers and they see the decline, and New York City itself has been very vocal about seeing the lowest murder rate in 3 decades and the lowest shooting incidents in years, people still don't necessarily feel safe. And my students tell me this regularly, like, they know the numbers show them safety, but when they're walking the streets, when they're riding the subways, they don't feel it. And a lot of Americans have reported that. There are surveys that show that more than 3/4 of the country understand statistically that the crime is going down. But for some reason, they just perceive this unsafe situation. So I think that that has a lot to do with the way the media spins these numbers. And I think that most people should understand that crime is going down. We are not seeing what we saw in 2020 and 2021. Yes, there are still some local cities that are experiencing some increases in violent crime or some increases in crime overall, but the large majority of this country is reporting very safe numbers. But, and again, I will always say, this accounts for only the reported crimes. It does not account for what people decided they didn't want to call 911 for. But I think that everyone should feel a little bit safer today looking at these numbers.
Yeah, you know, as you say, the data can only get you so far. This is something that is also obviously an emotional issue, too. And we're all probably just a little too anxious all the time about everything. I think that probably contributes to it. But, you know, hey, the data is there. The data is solid. Everybody is certainly statistically safer than you were a few years ago. And that is wonderful news. Jillian, thanks for taking some time and talking us through all this today.
Thank you so much.
And once again, that is Jillian Snyder. She is a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute. Check out their fine work on a wide variety of topics at rstreet.org. And of course, check our coverage of criminal justice issues and everything else going on around the country at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
At one time, CBS was so well regarded, it was referred to as the Tiffany Network. It has since lost its luster. But on this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring says CBS has an opportunity to restore its lost sparkle.
When I was literally a little boy in short pants, my father took me to a CBS radio studio in New York. He was a director in the final days of radio soap operas, and he wanted me to see for myself how those amazing shows were produced live. Although he had shows on both NBC and CBS, he wanted me to see CBS because, in his words, CBS was the best network. Less than 20 years later, I joined CBS, solid in my own conviction that CBS was indeed the best company in broadcasting, especially in the area of news. It was the home of Edward R. Murrow, Walter Cronkite, and Eric Severide, Peabody Award winners all. The Peabody Awards are the highest honor for radio and television journalism. In my 7 years with CBS Radio, it led the broadcast industry in developing the news radio format. CBS Evening News anchor Walter Cronkite was known as the most trusted man in America. CBS was known as the Tiffany Network, and its crown jewel was its news division. CBS had the highest TV ratings, the best sports division, with the likes of Jack Whitaker and Pat Summerall, and even the most impressive building, BlackRock, designed by Eero Saarinen. But above it all was the preeminence of its news division. I was immensely proud of CBS. How that jewel has become tarnished in the years since. The scandal of Dan Rather's uncritical use of forged documents besmirching George W. Bush's military record, and the more recent scandal of 60 Minutes manipulating Kamala Harris's interview responses to make her sound and look less incoherent than she really was, are just two examples of how badly CBS lost its journalistic integrity. But now that CBS has been sold to new owners, it has a new opportunity to regain its position of honor. It can wipe its slate clean and start over by recapturing the principles of honest journalism, principles that virtually all its competitors have wantonly abandoned. ABC, NBC, MSNBC, and CBS all openly embrace the political and cultural agenda of the left, while Fox News does much the same on the right. CNN had a chance to find the middle among cable news outlets, but decided instead to capitulate to the liberals in their management and create a slightly diluted version of MSNBC's leftist bias. The website allsides.com has developed a very useful media bias meter with five categories: left, leans left, center, leans right, and right. It's quite a good effort. It covers major print, cable, and broadcast outlets. CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, and NPR are all in the leans left category. MSNBC, of course, is in the full left category. Fox News, Newsmax, OAN, and CBN are all on the right. But of particular interest to me is the fact that the category with the fewest entries is center. There is not a single broadcast or cable news provider in the center, not one. Nor is there one in leans right. Honest and unbiased news is a category virtually begging for attention, and if CBS were to make that its strategic goal, they'd be on their way back to respectability unchallenged. News fatigue, outrage fatigue, or negativity fatigue all refer to the state of being mentally and physically drained due to prolonged exposure to negative news and emotions. CBS was once the home of Andy Rooney and Charles Kuralt. If CBS were to bring back honest, fact-based, inspiring coverage of true stories in that vein, they'd have an audience all to themselves. Mike Rowe's success in television streaming and podcasting demonstrates that the appetite for uplifting and honest stories of real people is huge. I am convinced that the same goes for real news. CBS, if you're listening, open that big eye that is your logo and see the opportunity that lies before you with your new ownership. If you return to the principles of genuine journalism, you'll be alone and again held in high honor. What a great new opportunity for a once great company. But I won't be standing on one leg waiting for them to seize it. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WFIL-AM and WNTP-AM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, along with WBNL-AM and FM in Boonville, Indiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.